Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac DeVere.
But you must know people who were in the union with you who...
I do.
So
what... Bothers me.
Why does it bother you?
Because I think they forgot where they came from. And I think the fact that, you know, I said the story on Labor Day. I was talking on Labor Day and I was talking about, you know, when I see a truck go by me down the street and on one side of the truck, it's the local union number. And then on the other side of the truck, it's Trump. And those numbers represent working people, and those numbers represent representation of people and helping people struggling and trying to make somebody's life better. And the other sticker on the other side, in my opinion, has nothing to do with helping people. I think it's all about. I can't even say Trump wants to help for his friends because it clearly doesn't. It's about ego, and I think that's not what the office of president is or any elective office. I think if you think you're bigger than the office, it's time for you to go, and that's any politician, including myself, in the United States of America.
Today's guest, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. Walsh is a college dropout, a union guy who grew up working class and still largely is. He's also a progressive and proud of it, on union issues, immigration, gay rights, and more. So that's what I wanted to talk to him about when I saw him in Boston recently. He seems to be the profile of a Trump voter, the ones who bled from the Democratic Party in 2016 in such huge numbers that they helped flip the election to him. And yet, Walsh couldn't be farther from Trump. He doesn't like him at all. How is that? And what does he think Democrats need to learn from that as they make the appeals to other Trump voters? And which Democrats does he think are anywhere near getting it right? He's also an alcoholic, and so we started the conversation by talking about that and how his experience drinking and giving up drinking decades ago informs still his thinking of what government can and should do in dealing with the opioid crisis and so much more. Remember to subscribe, rate us, leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or however you're listening. Tell a friend, tell a coworker, and email me your thoughts at isaac@politico.com. Follow me on Twitter at Isaac DeVere. So much more to come. And now, my conversation with Marty Walsh.
So you've told this story before, but I think it's worth people hearing. Can you tell me about the night you had your last drink?
You know, it was a weekend, really. It was a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday type of thing. You know, just drinking to a blackout, oblivion on Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And then on Sunday, that Sunday, I got up and went to the bar again in the morning around 11:30, 12 o'clock, and went to the Bruins game. You know, was asked to leave the Bruins game. It's a nice way of saying I was thrown out of the Bruins game. And then I went across the street to a bar and ordered a drink and fell asleep. Passed out, really. And then woke up in my house that night, probably about 9 o'clock at night, and just desperation, you know, not knowing what to do, where to turn to. Plenty of family in recovery. Never really took a shot at recovery before. Never took a shot at AA before. And I made some phone calls. I had to call my boss.
You're how old at this point?
I'm 28 at the time. So basically, next morning, I got up, go to work, and go down to my boss. And he's basically, it suggests, tells me I have to make a phone call to the EAP program. And I did. And it started my journey. I talked to a guy on the phone and explain where I was a little bit in my life. I didn't give the whole story because everyone's in denial. They recommended I go inpatient to Gosnells. Had no desire or intention of doing that. Gosnells a rehab in Boston, down the Cape. And I end up going down. And the first night I was there, a group of people came in to speak and put on a commitment. They call it a commitment, where they speak about their recovery. It hooked me. And from that point on until today, you know, it was the grace of God into my life. You know, my life has been incredible. I've worked on myself, worked on all of the wreckage from the past but also learning how to kind of cope and live life a day at a time. And that's what I do.
You still going to meetings?
Yeah, as much as I can. It's hard right now. I'd love to go to more. Yeah. But I do go, cause it still levels me off. I have no desire to drink. But it's a way of life. It allows me the opportunity to like really sit back and be in my, you know, listen and kind of think for an hour and a half or an hour when I'm in there.
It's anonymous, but you walk in, people must know you're the mayor.
Yeah, some people do, some people don't.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, no one cares. I mean, I've been going long enough. You know, I'm Marty, an alcoholic in that room. You know, there's other people in that room that have careers and you know, do things. And, you know, you're just yourself in that room. And it shows you that we're all human and no one's different. It doesn't matter if I'm the mayor of Boston or or if you, you know, if you're a construction worker, or if you, you're a house homekeeper, or you're whatever you are, we're all the same in that room. We're all people dealing with an issue.
And you're still taking phone calls from people who,
you know, yeah, you have
to. I mean, on your cell phone, right? Like, that's the number. I know. I mean,
I'm dealing,
I'm
dealing
crazy,
with a situation right now, and a kid I grew up with, and you know, I'm dealing with a situation with him, and he's in some trouble, and trying to help him, and you know, suggest to him that, you know, this is the right thing to do, and you know, but you have to. And yeah, during the campaign when I first ran for mayor, that people wanted me to change the number, I just couldn't. Too many people have the number that, you know, from the recovery world, and at some point, I guess I'll change it because a lot of people have the number now.
I mean, but people you're pretty far down the road.
People
on this,
don't.
Right?
People don't. I mean, honestly, people don't bother me on the phone. I don't get as many calls as people would think, even though the amount of people have my cell phone. But it's those folks that are in recovery or that I've tried to help over the years. You know, you never know when they're going to call.
The reason why I want to start with that is because I want to talk a little bit about opioids and what's going on and what isn't going on to deal with things. And you come at it from this perspective of having been in recovery, not for opioids, obviously, but for alcohol.
Which is the same thing.
What are we getting wrong about how we approach this as a country?
I think we're getting wrong the fact that we think we can fix it through government intervention. I think that that's one thing. I think that, you know, you're talking millions and millions and millions of people, and, you know, governments don't fix cancer. Governments don't necessarily fix cystic fibrosis. We assist in the disease, in the treatment. There's a lot of illnesses that we don't, as a mayor, people don't say, well, you got to fix people getting strokes because it's important. It's not gonna be that way. I mean, this is a problem since probably the beginning of time. The opioid crisis is really probably since the 90s, 2000s, you know, a lot of alcohol before, and there was drugs before, there's no question about it, but you know, with the narcotics, it was a game changer on the drug side. So I don't think you can fix it simply. It's going to take time. It's probably going to take, you know, we have to limit the access to opioids. I know that we have prescription monitoring programs, and we have all these different programs, and all these big pharmaceutical companies now want to be involved and want to help, and I commend them for it. Some of them created this problem, and they should help, and they should put some of their money, more of their money, not $10 million, because they've made billions. So I think that the issue is going to be partly, you know, having better regulations on prescriptions.
So that's government, right?
Yeah, that's government to some degree, but it's also self-policing when it comes to some of these companies. I think some of these pharmaceutical companies now see the fact that, oh my God, we can get rich by coming up with a drug to prevent people from taking drugs. Well, that's one part of it, but getting in recovery, I'm kind of switching gears here a little bit, going into treatment, people who are addicts, it can't just be a pill or a shot. It has to be something, because what happens is, I mean, when I got sober, you know, I had to deal with the person first. I had to deal with my outside and deal with the fact that I craved alcohol. And a drug addict has to deal with the fact that they crave drugs. So you got to deal with the craving, and then you have to figure that out. And then after you get sober and you get some clean time, the next thing you have to deal with is who you hurt. And how do you deal with that? You can ignore it. But if you ignore it, that will always be in your head. So there's a process. So when I talk about in recovery and talk about, I'm jumping around here, but I'll come back to the pharmaceuticals. You know, coming up with a prescription to fix an addiction is one thing, but you still have all of that pain and suffering that you cause other people and yourself that you have to deal with. So I get concerned that we're going to try and fix the problem of addiction with a pill, which yes, it'll stop somebody from taking a pill, and I support them wholeheartedly, but they also have to deal with the past.
But so what do you do? What is the role?
What we're doing in Boston is as far as the government side of it, you know, we created the Office of Recovery Services. And that office is part of working on solutions, both what's happening in our streets and our corners, and also what's happening in some of our programming in the city. I think that that's one piece. I think government also is responsible for making sure that there are good some programs, public programs like detoxes and holdings. And we have a shortage. I would argue we have a shortage in halfway house beds. These are long-term treatment beds. And that's partly of what I want to do in Long Island, is create a long-term treatment kind of campus out in Long Island, so that people that go into treatment, that wants to go into this next step of treatment, that they actually have a bed there. And I think that that's important. Some people can't get into a detox bed. Some people can't get into a detox bed, quite honestly, because they're not telling the truth either to their family. Oh, there's no beds available. They make that up. So we can get people, and people can get into a detox bed if they truly want to get into recovery. But what we're doing is making, how do you make these programs accessible? So our Office of Recovery Services is creating ways of making access into these programs. We also have changed our 311 line. Our 311 in Boston is the main number for City Hall. So if you have a pothole or a street light out or a tree planted, you want to plant the tree, whatever you want to do, you call 311. If you have a problem with addiction, with drugs and alcohol, you can call 311. And we will partner you up with a recovery program. And also, if you're a family member or somebody that just doesn't know what to do and you're struggling and saying, I'm at wit's end with this person, I don't know what to do, and they don't know who to turn to, they can call 311 and we can help them with that as well.
It seems like part of what happened in the last couple of years of the world, the country at large, realizing what was going on is people say, oh, I didn't even know that this person was taking pills or whatever. And there's part of the thing that I think a lot of people who aren't addicts and who aren't involved in it deal with is thinking like, well, why are they taking pills? Why are they drinking? It doesn't make any sense, right?
Yeah. It's an addiction. I mean, you just the pills change the game. You know, a lot of times people that I've talked to in the over the years in recovery, whether a drug addict or an alcoholic, you know, they had a family member that was an addict somewhere down the road. You know, OxyContin changed the game.
But like, why did you drink?
I think I started out as just because
it you said you liked beer, right?
I guess we all did it, and I liked the taste of it, and I liked the feeling, and then it just snowballs into, you know, glutton. You become a glutton.
Yeah.
It's like anybody. I mean, some people who are overweight, obese, they woke, you know, they were in shape young, and they just liked to eat, and they just kept eating and eating and eating. And if no one intervened in their life, then what happens is you're sitting there like, oh, my God, look at me. And same with alcohol and drugs, like, look at me. And it's addiction. It's an addictive personality. You take on this whole personality, and it's like anything. It's politics. It's media, guys. People who work for the media who just love stories and chasing. You get the high off of. Yeah. I'm not saying high, but you get the high off of chasing the story. Mm-hmm. That's what happens. And sometimes you got to take a step back because even reporters, you have a family, you have friends, and all of a sudden now you've ignored them and you're off and running.
I didn't realize this was going to become.
Let's talk about it. How do you feel about it? I think that, you know, that's what happens. I mean, addiction is tough when you get grabbed by addiction, whatever it is, it could be candy, cigarettes, potato chips, anything, running,
I guess.
Some people just run all the time and they become addicted with running. Yeah. Maybe it's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying they're compulsive.
It's right. Yeah. How it hits in your brain. Yeah. It's a big piece of who you are, but another big piece of who you are is your background in unions and labor. You are a rarity as someone who was a prominent labor leader who is now a prominent politician.
I don't think it was always that way.
Yeah. So what went wrong with unions in this country? What happened? We're in a bad moment for organized labor.
Organized labor, you know, I think in some cases labor didn't change with the times or hasn't changed with the times enough. I think when, depending on what area you're in, I mean, there's a lot of different unions. There's teachers unions, there's service employees, there's building trades. I came out of the building trades. You have public employee unions, you have private unions. And I think some unions, some organizations are doing it really well. I think some of the SEIUs are doing it really well, and they're organizing and organizing people. I think some unions and some people got complacent in what they had, and they figured, okay, this is it. I think the fact that I think not building relations with the business community was important, was a mistake. I think that you know, when I took over the building trades in 2011, I think it was, I really reached out to the employer community. I reached out to the non-union sector and trying to build relationships there. I mean, I knew that I might not get the work at the time, but it's about relationships. And now as mayor, I kind of see it a little differently. I mean, I work with all the different sectors. I work with the non-union sector, the developers, and you know, it goes back to relationships. And I think, you know, depending on the industry, look at the building trades. The building trades, there's no argument. The building trades have the best qualified, trained people in the country. And they train the people the best. And I think that there's an opportunity there in the building trades to use your training as an as a strength to mm-hmm. organize. I think public employees, I think part of the issue too is that union members don't understand what the union stands for.
Mm-hmm.
I think that sometimes public employees are represented by a union and they get a job, they get a representation, and they don't quite understand what that means. And they don't, it's not just about fighting for wages. It's about fighting for working conditions, and it's also about supporting other people's solidarity. And I think that message has been lost.
Yeah, there's a lot of suspicion that seems to have gotten baked into, at least around the political side.
And it's unfortunate. Okay. I mean, I think that, there's, unions generally were formed in the early 20th century and they had a purpose. And, we had child labor laws and we came in, they brought in, fought for Social Security and overtime rights and the work week and, all that stuff came into play. And there's still battles today, but they're not the same battles. The work week's established, the overtime rules were established, the workers' comp's established. So you have to figure out what exactly it is. It can't just be about beating up companies saying, oh, they're bad, because it's not the case. And companies shouldn't say unions are bad, but the experience between both are bad. It's not a real close relationship in a lot of ways. And I think if you talk to employers that use unions that have a good relationship, will tell you a very different story than other people. I know there's a place in this country for the labor movement. And I think that it has to evolve and change depending on the unions.
Should organized labor be more political? Should it be less political?
I think being involved
in campaigns directly.
The business community is involved in campaigns too. I mean, when I ran for mayor the first time in 2013, many people in the business community did not support me. And they were
the union guy.
They had this perception. I was the fear of me. And then in 2017, a lot of people were like, oh my God, you've been great. And now that, people like, I hope you stay as mayor. I want you to keep running because the city's booming and you're doing great things. And I appreciate that because I try to tell that story to people that, this is not going to be a bad thing if I get elected mayor. And it hasn't been.
Yeah. Your life story, the way that you, and it's every piece of what you've been through, I think feels like it defines you, right? You grew up working class, your parents were immigrants themselves from Ireland, all the things we've talked about. It feels like a lot of people who have lived parallel lives to yours would come out, and at least in the 2016 election, were turning toward Trump. And it's one of the things I want to talk to you about. Because you come out, you live those same life experiences, and you come out a progressive, a Democrat, someone who was all in for Hillary Clinton, and I'm guessing you don't regret that and haven't thought that you made a mistake and it should have been with Trump. So why how does that happen?
I just think it's the person. I think it's our personalities and what we do. I mean, I've had plenty of arguments about with people that grew up like me, Irish parents,
mm-hmm.
Immigrant parents, same neighborhood. We didn't have a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And they get caught up in the rhetoric of immigrants are awful people and we got to throw them out of the country. And I just think it's I think it's your own individual identity and how it's formed. I think my experiences in life brought me here as well. I think the fact that at the time when I had cancer at the age of 7, I didn't think of it at the time, obviously. And I didn't even think of it when I was in high school. But as I got older, I realized, wow.
You've gotten so used to telling that story that you just sort of brushed past it. But this was like a major moment in your life.
Yeah. So when I got older, I realized, wow, this is pretty significant. When I turned in my 20s and I started to talk to doctors and I went over to the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and they created what's called the Perini Clinic, which was a follow-up for adults who had childhood cancer. And I started talking about it and this was serious. And they went through all the stuff and you realize like, I overcame, I didn't at the time, I was 7, so you don't know what's going on, you're going through your head. So that was part of me. And then being in recovery, I mean, it makes you realize like that you know better than anyone else. And it's recovery for me grounds me and grounds me to make me realize like you asked earlier about me going to a meeting and you're the mayor of Boston. Most people don't look at me as the mayor of Boston in the meeting. After the meeting's over, they might grab me and say, can you help me? But during the meeting, I'm just another person in the room holding the seat, having a cup of coffee. And I think I hope that keeps me humble. And I try to stay humble. Becoming mayor, you make a lot of new friends. And you have a lot of people that want to talk to you and invite you to things. And, there's probably a good chance that the day that I'm not the mayor anymore, I'm not getting the same advice as much as I am today. And so for me personally, I think it's all of my life experiences have kept me to who I am.
But you must know people who were in the union with you who...
I do.
So
what... bothers me.
Why does it bother you?
Because I think they forgot where they came from. And I think the fact that, you know, I said the story on Labor Day. I was talking to Labor Day and I was talking about, you know, when I see a truck go by me down the street and on one side of the truck, it's the local union number. And then on the other side of the truck, it's Trump. And those numbers represent working people. And those numbers represent representation of people and helping people struggling and trying to make somebody's life better. And the other sticker on the other side, in my opinion, has nothing to do with helping people. I think it's all about. I can't even say Trump wants to help for his friends because it clearly doesn't. It's about ego. And I think that's not what the office of president is or any elective office. I think if you think you're bigger than the office, it's time for you to go. And that's any politician, including myself, in the United States of America. And I think what's turned people off and maybe turned some of those folks that have voted for Trump off is that they feel that politicians or they know the politicians think that they're bigger than the office they hold. And that's not the case.
So what do you do to get those people to come back and be Democrats?
You have to continue. I think the Democratic Party needs to come up with a real strong platform. I mean, I think it's important that the party does that. I think the party needs to talk to mayors. I think the party needs to talk to elected officials. I think the party needs to talk to people. They're not doing it right now. And after they hear this, they're like, oh, yes, we are. No, they're not. and I think that elected officials in Washington, leadership, who I like and respect, I think they need to start figuring out what people want to hear and start taking input in. Not one person is going to come back and save this party. You know, there's a lot of people talking about who's running for president and this and that. Not one person. We'll rally around that person president. That doesn't mean they fix the party and get more people engaged in the Democratic Party. And the same for the Republican Party. I think they're going through the same problem. But I think the parties need to start listening to what the people really want. And what the major concerns are in this country. And you can't be everything to everybody, but the party, Democratic Party, has to be an option for anyone that wants to be part of it. So if you are a white, rich person from New York City, the Democratic Party should be an option for you. If you are an immigrant from East Boston in Boston, the party should be an option for you. If you are a African-American in Atlanta, Georgia, the party should be an option for you. If you are... anybody, the party should be an option for you. Democratic Party should be an option. And right now, I think a lot of people are just frustrated with the whole political system of parties. And but I think that's kind of why Trump, I think, got elected in some ways.
Well, it was about pushing back on the whole system and what had happened, at least part of what was driving him. But if you're sitting down and there's a guy you know, and he says, I'm going to vote for Trump again.
I'm going to explain the difference between Trump and the difference between me, the difference between Trump and the difference between the parties, the difference between...
Well, what's that difference?
I think the difference is healthcare.
Yeah.
I think that's, you know, healthcare is something that everyone in this country needs. And that guy sitting across from me, whether it's him or his children, are going to need healthcare. I think it's talking about Social Security. A lot about what was in the New Deal, about preserving what was in the New Deal. I think that's important. I think also talking about diversity in the part of diversity in this country that's a positive. Everyone looks at diversity in some ways as a negative, I think, or immigration.
But how do you convince them that that's a positive in your mind?
Explain what's going on in Boston. 28% of the people live in our city are foreign born. 48% of the people in our city are first generation. We have immigrants in this city that are citizens. We have immigrants in this city that have green cards on pathways to citizenship. We have immigrants in this city that are undocumented. We have right now in Boston, as we sit here this morning, we have $11 billion worth of construction going on in our city. We've had 85,000 new people move in the last 4 years. We're one of the safest cities in America. We have our challenges. Talk about the story of what's happening in our city and the diversity and how we can be not a melting pot of America, but you can look at Boston and say, wow, that's a pretty good snapshot of what's happening in America.
Does anyone out there on the national stage get it, you think, of the Democrats?
I think Joe Biden gets it.
He came and inaugurated you.
You know, he came and inaugurated, so I have to say Joe Biden. No, I think Joe gets it. I think, you know, I think the fact that Joe grew up in a working class family and he talks about that. I mean, you know, you hear the Joe Biden talk today about, he's not here today, but we hear Joe Biden talk today. He talks about working class people and you hear him talk 35 years ago when he started in this business or whenever he did it. You know, he's talking about working class people.
More than 35 years
ago. He started talking about working class people. I think, you know, you have people like Eric Garcetti, who's here, mayor, who's talking about looking. I think he's exploring. We have not talked about it, but you know, he's another one that that understands his city. You know, Mitchell Andrew comes from the South, from New Orleans and Louisiana. So he's, you know, he has understands being a mayor. He understands it. And there's a whole bunch of other people talking about running that I'm not sure if I don't know much about them. So I'm sure we'll learn about them.
Let me ask you about Elizabeth Warren, who's your senator, who may run. And she has a, but whether she runs or doesn't, she has a prescription of what went wrong with companies and banks getting too much power and having, and that that's the root of how things happen here. And there needs to be like a fundamental reset of
that's part of it. But you can't just be, it can't just be an anti campaign. And I'm not saying Senator Warren is going to do that because she's a great senator, but it also has to be what's the some people don't care about that in the public. I mean, those people that you talked about, the voter for Trump, they don't, they live in working class neighborhoods. They're not. Banking industry really is not an impact on them unless they have a bad mortgage. They're not sure about that. And what they're concerned about is making sure that, you know, that there's a job tomorrow and making sure that their family has a place to stay and they can earn a living and put food on the table and send their kids to school and send their kids to college. That's what people are worried about.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, that's one side of it. And I commend the senator for all her great work on that. The other side, there's more to it. And I think she understands as well. I should have thrown her in there.
No, she. I mean, look, she grew up the daughter of a janitor.
Yeah, and she understands that. And her brother was an operating engineer. And so she understands that as well. And I think that, you know, I think that there's, that's important. What happens in a presidential campaign is that they focus on three issues that most people don't care about, or they care, they should care about, but they focus on three or four issues. I mean, the Republican primary last year, you know, you had them making fun of each other, the size of their hands and insulting each other. It was embarrassment. And on the Democratic primary, you had, you know, people were talking about universal college and all this. Bernie Sanders was talking about college and things like that. And then, you know, what he needs to talk about, if he's going to talk about stuff like that and get people energized, how's he going to pay for it?
Yeah.
So he has to, they left that out yet in that presidential
campaign. The criticism that I hear sometimes about that is that when people talk about those kinds of proposals, free college, that a lot of working class people say like, well, it won't be free for me, right? Like, right. And I'm going to end up paying for it in some way. Middle class people feel that way too. And that's that gets at some of the issues that the Democrats have here in appealing to people who.
Well, that's why that's why as a Democrat or as any candidate, that's why you have to talk about all the people. I'll give you an example. So in Boston here, you know, we created a program 2 years ago, free community college for low income families. Okay, at Bunker Hill, Roxbury Community College, and Mass Bay, and that was our first talk about it. And we were really pushing that to low income families. So now there's families in Dorchester in Boston saying, well, you know, I'm not low income, but I'm not rich either, and how do I get my kids to school? And what we did then was we worked with college universities to create more opportunities for scholarship programs and tuition programs for all kids in Boston. So when you think about it, we think about it through the lens of helping young people that income inequality or poverty is so important for us to help pull out. But we also have to make sure that we do other things in Boston to make sure the middle class can access it as well. Because even though you're in the middle class, it doesn't mean that you're rich.
Right.
It just means that you have you're in better situation.
Than people in the middle class who feel like they're suffering, they're struggling, right?
Yeah, they're struggling week to week or two paychecks away from being losing their house. So, you know, we are trying to. When we think of policies in Boston, we think of that population. We're building housing in Boston. We're revamping our housing plan right now, and we're really going to focus on moderate low income housing for Boston. Those are families that live in poverty under the poverty line, and those are families that are making a little bit in the middle class. And how do we create more opportunities for those people to come here?
Gay rights has been a big cause for you for a long time. You were in the bill that would have repealed gay marriage here in Massachusetts when you were in the state house, the key vote there. I guess on that also, I would ask you how you make that case. So this is another thing that. A lot of Democrats are for, more Republicans are for than maybe seems to be represented by the national conversation, but there is certainly a strain of people who are pulling back on it.
I don't understand that. I mean, it's 2018. When I got elected in the legislature in 97, we were in the midst of debating domestic partner benefits. You know, we were going to do it, and the legislature didn't do it, and leadership didn't do it, which was a mistake. And then a couple of years later, we talked about civil unions and we were going to do it and they didn't do it. And I was always kind of suggesting we do it and as a legislator because, it, you know, it was the right thing to do. And then marriage equality came to Massachusetts in 2004. It was preserved in Massachusetts by representatives and senators. And then became national law a couple of years ago. It's a conversation I'm baffled by, because you have people that are fighting this. Everybody knows somebody, and just about now, it's not quite yet, but everybody's family has somebody who's gay in the family. And we have ruling from the United States Supreme Court the other day that says that they're allowing bakeries not to have to make a cake if they don't want to for a gay couple. That's the most ludicrous thing I've ever heard in my life. That the United States Supreme Court, who have made some incredible rulings over its history,
mm-hmm.
And have done some incredible decisions in changing the direction of this country, are making decisions like that. This one's making decisions like that. I think it's sad.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the justices that voted for this ban, you know, I hope when they go to a family party, their family says to them, really? Because I think it's just sad. It's just sad. The conversation of gay rights, it's over. The people, transgender folks in America.
It's not over. It's, I mean.
No, but it should be, is what I'm saying. Yeah. It's just, I don't understand it. Like, it baffles me. The people that are listening that are gay or transgender, just remember that you have a lot of people that are allies for you. And don't let the naysayers get you down.
We've touched on immigration a bunch of ways, but look, you said City Hall was going to be a sanctuary.
Yeah.
So again, can you make that case to the Trump supporter, the person who you said, remember where you came from? That's part of it. It seems like to you, but like, how do you say to them, people say that our jobs are going away to immigrants and they're worried and they're responding to what the president and others have touched on.
Those jobs that are going away to immigrants are going to immigrants because people aren't working them. And that's the fact. I think that if you look around many of our restaurants and the hospitality industry, a lot of immigrants work in that industry. And if the immigrants weren't working in that industry, we'd be hard pressed to find somebody working in that industry. And just like the generation before that, there were immigrants in those same jobs from different countries. Many of them were our parents that worked in those fields and the next generations from a different place. I think that, you know, Trump villainizing, you know, when you have a crime committed and villainizing, you know, when there's a crime committed by somebody who's here undocumented, that's a horrible thing.
And it must happen in Boston, right?
It does happen in Boston. And if it's a heinous crime, you know, a felony, we notify the federal authorities and they move them out of here. And they should be. But you can't paint every crime in America as being performed by somebody who's an immigrant. It's just not the case.
But why not get the undocumented immigrants out of the if they're committing crimes? Why not?
Well, how are we going to do that? We have 14 million people in this country. I don't know how we're going to do that.
Is that what it comes down to as a practical question?
No, this is a failure in the national government. This is a failure for many administrations. It's a complete failure. It's a failure not to have deal with immigration reform. You know, you can deal with immigration reform. You can reform the system. You can figure out a pathway to citizenship, and you can strengthen our borders and protect and not protect, but lock our borders if you want. That's fine. Do that. But deal with.
But
the
that's
issue.
Not fine for you.
No,
right?
No, it's fine. If it's a law and they pass it, if Congress got together tomorrow and said, "Okay, this is what we're going to do. We're gonna deal with the 14 million people that are here. We're either going to grant them citizenship, or we're going to have create a pathway to citizenship where you have 3 or 4 or 5 years to become a citizen, pay your taxes, do all the stuff, and then you can stay here because you've lived as a good model citizen, no problems, no troubles, anything else. You can stay here. You deal with the 14 million in America. And then you figure out on the borders what we do with our borders. Mm-hmm. And I don't think a wall works. Mm-hmm. I think we have enough technology in America to say that there's somebody crossing the border over in Arizona or in Texas or part of Texas to figure out, okay, let's go get these people because they're over there. And when we catch people at the border and the law is you can't come in unless you have to go to your embassy and appeal. Mm-hmm. And we allow certain quotas of different
it's
nationalities.
It's a pretty stringent system that you've now created.
But it's stringent right now. Government's stringent. I mean, buying a house is stringent.
So your point is if you're going to have the rhetoric, it needs to be more than rhetoric.
He hasn't. The president hasn't once proposed anything.
Yeah.
like, he's been there now long enough.
Yeah. Year and a half.
He's been there long enough to figure out you need legislation. He has not proposed one thing. What he's done, he does an executive order, which anyone can do an executive order, which gives teeth for him.
Mm-hmm.
But for him, all his executive orders have been taken to the court. And or he tweets. That's not governing. That's not leadership. That'd be like me, you know, tweeting. You know, last night in Boston, we had some shootings in Boston. Me, instead of myself, what I did this morning is have a conversation with the commissioner about what we're going to do today. I tweet out, well, it's horrible what happened in Boston last night. We really have to do something with these murdering gun, you know, slingers on the streets of Boston. That doesn't solve the problem for me. And I still have to wake up the next day. So we have a problem. We have to deal with the issue.
Do you write your own tweets?
No. I did a couple, and then I got that privilege was taken away from me. Because sometimes people.
But there must be time.
I mean, like, tweet crazy things, and I'm like, I want to respond. I'm like, I don't even bother. I did once. I made one comment years ago, and I'm still paying the kickback from that.
There's something that the immediacy of tweeting, and people want to do it.
Oh, yeah, I try not. If I want a good laugh, I'll read my Twitter feed because some of the things that people tweet about me. It's insane. And so, but there's some good stuff out there too. I don't have access to it. If I do, when I do tweet, I tweet out an MJW next week. So people know it's me.
Do you think Charlie Baker is going to be reelected governor?
Probably has a good chance at it. Yeah. I think that
should he be?
The Democratic, you know, let me just say we have a Democratic primary, some good candidates, two good candidates running for governor. You know, Jay Gonzalez has the background and certainly A&F secretary for the state. So he knows the state government pretty intently, intricately. Bob Massey, putting on some really incredible platforms and putting a lot of time and effort into them. If you read them, some interesting stuff, some stuff I agree with. And then the governor's worked hard. I mean, you know,
he's a Republican in Massachusetts, which is always, he's not the first Republican governor in Massachusetts. Why does that happen?
I don't know why it happened, I've served. When I got elected to the House, Bill Weld was the governor, and then Paul Cilucci came in behind him. I had a really good relationship with Paul Cilucci's people and the governor Cilucci. And then Governor Romney came in. I didn't have as good a relationship with Romney. He was here for 5 minutes and then was running for president. And then Kerry Haley, who's lieutenant governor, was Republican. A good relationship with Kerry. She did a lot around opioids and back in the day and worked really hard. And then Governor Patrick came in and then he brought a whole new group of people that came in here. And he was a good governor. You know, his people, some way, like, act. I think when you're in the governor's office, I was a rep now. I'm talking as a rep. So you get frustrated with the administration because sometimes they're putting roadblocks up and stiff arming you and things like that. Because
not used to having a Democratic governor. Also, one Democratic governor in 30 years.
It was a learning process. We kind of figured out, well, is this what we do now? And then Governor Baker came in, and I don't know what people expected. I mean, I supported Martha Coakley. I'm not sure what people expected. I know he ran in 2010, Governor Baker, and you know, at the time there was a lot of concern about who he was and what he stood for. He came out of a healthcare company and. You know, now at this point, I'm a labor state rep, so we're out there battling away against them. But this time, he got elected governor, and he reached out immediately. And I think one of the things that is key to the Baker administration is they work really intently in the relationships with mayors and cities and towns. And I think that's why people like them, and they respond. There's no time lapse. So when you call there, you're not waiting. Like sometimes you'll call an elected official. My God, you'll get a call back 3 months later. Oh, you just got your message. You call the governor or governor's office. I mean, he told his people, I think, to make sure you return calls to the municipalities because they're important. That's why I think he's popular. What he does, and he's a regular person. He comes out and talks about people. So the question was, do you think he'd be beaten? Anyone can be beaten.
But should he be? It seems like you're not. You're not gung ho that he should be.
That's something the voters will decide. Should he be or should he not be?
Let me ask you two more here. What about you? Boston mayors tend to be mayors for life. I remember seeing your predecessor, Tom Menino, right after he was done coming to the coming to the White House for the Red Sox victory celebration, back when sports teams used to come to the White House.
That was back in the good old days.
But he was already an old man at that point. Do you think of yourself as a mayor for life? Or no. If you want to be, do you have aspirations for other office?
I don't know yet. I have my first term. I wasn't really focused on any other office. I was just focused on how to get this job right and to do it right and do the best job I can for the people of the city of Boston. And then the U.S. Conference of Mayors obviously got me a little engaged on a national stage. And then we had a presidential election, so I got even more engaged on a national stage. But ultimately, you come back home and you do your job here in the city. Mayor Menino was mayor for 20 years. I won't be mayor for 20 years.
Someone said to me, ask him if he's going to run for governor. I said, don't you make mayors for much longer than...
Yeah. Governors usually wait. I don't know. We'll see. I'm not sure what's next for me. Who knows? I mean, I live my life a day at a time.
Yeah.
I am 6 months into my second term. We have a lot of policy that we want to do. We have a lot of things we want to do. We want to continue to build new schools in Boston. We're making investments in infrastructure. We want to continue to bring more companies to our city. We want to continue to build more housing. I'm not done here yet, by a long shot. We're renovating Boston Common and Franklin Park and all our park system. So there's a lot of work I still want to do here in Boston. And I don't want to be the guy that, here and 6 years in and then all of a sudden jumping because I want to just because a better light showed up, something more shiny. I want to try and accomplish a lot of great things. At the end of the day, I'm going to live in the city. I'm going to be in the city. I want to be proud of the work that we did in this period that I'm the mayor. And I have incredible people working with me every day that are doing great things. And I want us all to be very proud to say between 2014 and whenever, we were able to do so many good things in the city of Boston. Look, the impact is still here today. That's what I'd like to see happen.
Sitting here right now, do you think that Donald Trump has a good chance of being reelected in 2020?
No, I think he has a chance, but who knows? I mean, it's hard to say. I think that
you worried about it.
I am a little bit because the margin is very small. I mean, I think that he has 35% of the people that love him, so they're going to come out and vote regardless of what happens. So he's starting with 35% base, and then all you have to do is get 16% more people to come over. And I'm not sure what's going to happen. So I hope that the American people take the next 2 years to really think about candidates who are running for president. And I think there could be some Republicans running, quite honestly. I don't think he's going to have a free ride. Think about what direction they want this country to go.
But people haven't moved as far away from Trump as you would want them to.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, you can't tell a poll. You read a poll one day and one news. I hope the media covers it differently. It's so, if you turn on one station, it's all Donald Trump. You turn another station, it's all anti-Donald Trump. We have to start
that. I know which stations you're talking about.
This president, and I watch one of them, and it's not the pro-Trump. But I think this election has to be covered in the sense of not Trump versus person. It has to be covered where America is today.
Yeah.
And I think that we need more stories about where's our water system in America. I don't think people understand how fragile our water system is in America. I don't think people understand how bad our infrastructure, roads, and rail are in this country. I think they have a good road system that we really don't.
Yeah.
It's crumbling. I think people need to understand that what's happening in the environment in our country, that in Boston, if we don't really focus on building protections on the harbor, what could happen if Superstorm Sandy comes, and then what's happening in the Midwest with forest fires? I think people need to understand what's at stake. What's at stake in this country is not necessarily undocumented immigrants. What's at stake in this country isn't some of the things that they're talking about. It's exactly our own backyard, what's happening. And I also think people need to start paying attention to foreign policy. You can't be playing around with the fact that we're going into a summit with a person who has nuclear weapons as a joke. This is serious. And we're ignoring Russia, and Russia's saying tariffs are being put on us by Mexico and Canada right now. We're United States of America. The people from my generation and after us, we put tariffs on people. They don't put them on us. we're going to be paying more for goods and services from Mexico and from Canada because of the president's inability to sit down and have a normal conversation with somebody. And I think that people need to, when you're thinking about the president of the United States of America, put all the noise away and vote what's right for the country and ultimately vote what's right for your pocketbook. You know, they just did the tax bill the other day. People are going to see a little bit of a bump next year. Long term, that tax benefit doesn't benefit the average American person. That tax benefit benefits millionaires and billionaires. And that's not right, because the average American person who's going to have trouble putting food on the table, like I said, might see an extra $2,000 next year in your tax return. But the year after, you're not going to see that.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's a good place to leave it, I guess. Although there's much more to say. Mayor Marty Walsh, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Well, what do you make of his diagnosis? Does he have a point? Or is he out of touch with where Trump voters are and where Democrats are and need to be? Email me at isaac@politico.com and let me know. Thanks, as always, to Zach Stanton for producing. Remember to subscribe and spread the word. Tell everyone you know. And, of course, follow me on Twitter, @IsaacDover, so you don't miss anything about upcoming episodes or other articles I'm working on. And catch you next time on Off Message.